Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Ursula K. Le Guin. Ursula K. Le Guin sold her first story 50 years ago and has been writing and publishing ever since. She is, of course, the author of the Earthsea science fiction series, the novel The Left Hand of Darkness, and more than 60 books of fiction, poetry, plays, translations, and essays. She has won more awards than we even have time to enumerate here, but they include a National Book Award, 5 Hugo Awards, 5 Nebula Awards, and the Penn Malmut Award. She has influenced several generations of writers and continues to do so today. Writers such as Junot Diaz, Kelly Link, David Mitchell, and Jonathan Lethem all cite her as an important influence. One reviewer said it best when she wrote, "It's been hard for reviewers to cope with Le Guin. She often seemed like a writer without a critical context, but that may just mean that the context is still to come." Let's hear Ursula K. Le Guin now. She spoke as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2000 in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland.
My glasses are hooked into my glasses case. Well, thank you very much, Carrie and Megan and Ola. Thank you, Portland, for giving us a home for the last 40-odd years. Thanks to all of you for giving up the thrill of the debate this evening. You give me hope for democracy. I hope to be the first of many Oregon and Northwest and West Coast writers here. I do feel that it really is unwise to encourage New York and those places in their illusions of centrality and their delusions of grandeur. This coast is really something. And now, you know, with the net and all that, geography means less than ever. But therefore, locality, being placed, the local community may be even more important. So, these very strict and cruel and harsh people that you've seen here do not allow one to read a story to you. So I will have to read you a non-story. And it is called Where Do You Get Your Ideas From? Which is the question which people in my line of work, fiction writers, get asked probably the most often, and we never know how to answer it. And so in self-defense, most of us develop a soundbite. And I like Harlan Ellison's. He says he gets his ideas from a mail-order house in Schenectady. Now, when people ask, where do you get your ideas from? What some of them really want to know is the address of that mail order company. That is, they want to write, or more likely what they want is to be a writer, because they know writers are rich and famous. And they know that there are secrets that writers know, like that address in Schenectady. And they know if they can just learn those secrets, those mystical P.O. box numbers, they will be Stephen King. But alas, writers really don't have secrets, except maybe the well-kept secret that about 99% of us are neither rich nor famous. Writers talk. Writers blab. Writers are wordy people. They talk and they whine. They whine all the time to each other about what they're writing and how it isn't going well. And they teach writing workshops and they write writing books and they yadder, yadder, yadder on talk shows. Writers tell all. If they could tell beginning writers where to get ideas from, they would. In fact, they do. All the time. Some of them actually get rich and famous by doing it. So what are the how to write writers say about getting ideas? They say stuff like, listen to conversations. Note down interesting things you hear or read. Keep a journal. Describe a character. Imagine a dresser drawer and describe what's in it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's all work. Anybody can do work. I want to be a writer. What's the P.O. box number? Well, okay, the secret to writing is writing. Writing is how you be a writer. It's only a secret to the people who don't really want to hear it. So, why did I want to answer this foolish question, where do you get your ideas from? Because as soon as you get beneath the foolish aspect of it, the question becomes very complicated and ultimately unanswerable, and unanswerable questions are just what fiction writers love. It is a big question. Where do writers get their ideas? Where do artists get their visions? Where do musicians get their music? It's bound to have a big answer, or maybe a whole lot of answers. One of my favorite answers is this. Somebody asked Willie Nelson how he thought of his tunes. And Willie said, well, the air is full of tunes. I just reach up and pick one. Now, that is not a secret, but it is a sweet mystery. It's a true mystery. That's what it is. For a fiction writer or a storyteller, the world is full of stories, and when a story is there, it's there, and you just reach up and pick it. And then you have to be able to let it tell itself. First, you have to be able to wait. I think that's what Willie didn't talk about. The waiting part. When you're silent, you're not singing. You wait in silence and you listen. You listen for the tune or the vision or the story. You're not grabbing, you're not pushing, you're just waiting and listening and being ready for it when it comes. This is an act of trust. Trust in yourself and trust in the world or your community. The artist says, the world will give me what I need and I will be able to use it rightly. So, readiness, not grabbiness, not greed, just readiness, willingness to hear, to listen carefully, to see accurately, to let the words be right, not almost right, right. To know how to make something out of the vision, that's what practice is for. Being ready doesn't mean just sitting around. Artists do practice all the time. Scales, finger exercises if you're a musician, pencil sketches, endless unfinished and rejected stories if you're a writer. The artist who practices knows the difference between practice and performance and the connection between them. The gift of those seemingly wasted hours and hours and years and years is patience and readiness. It's a good ear, a keen eye, and a skilled hand. a rich vocabulary and grammar. The gift of practice to the artist is mastery, or the word I prefer, craft. Well, with those tools, with those instruments, with that hard-earned mastery, that craftiness, then you do your best to let the idea, the tune, the vision, the story, to let it come through clear, undistorted, clear of ineptitude and awkwardness and amateurishness, undistorted by convention or fashion or, most insidious of all, opinion. Now, this is a very radical job, this dealing with the ideas you get if you're an artist and you take your art seriously. This shaping a vision into the medium of words. It is what I like to do best and what I like to talk about when I talk about writing, and I could go happily on and on about this craft part of it, but I'm trying to talk about where the vision, the stuff you work on, the idea comes from. So, okay, the air is full of tunes, right? A piece of rock is full of statues, right? The earth is full of visions. The world is full of stories. As an artist, you trust that. You trust that it is so. You know it is so. You know that whatever your experience, it will give you the material, the ideas for your work. And from here on, I'm leaving out music and fine arts and just sticking to storytelling, which is the only thing I really know anything about. Okay, these ideas. What is that word, ideas? What does that mean? Idea is, I think, a shorthand way of saying the material, the subject. The subject, the matter of a story. What the story is about. What the story is. But idea is a really strange word for something that is imagined, that isn't abstract, it's intensely concrete, it's not intellectual, it's embodied. But idea is the word we're stuck with. And it isn't wholly off-center because imagination is a rational faculty. I got the idea for that story from a dream I had. I haven't had a good story idea all year. Here I am sitting after half the morning crammed with ideas and visions and so on, and I can't dislodge them for lack of the right rhythm. Now that last sentence, I made up the first two, but the last one was written in 1926 by Virginia Woolf in a letter to a writer friend, and I'm going to come back to it in the end of this talk, because what she says about rhythm goes deeper than anything I've ever thought or read about where art comes from. But before I can talk about rhythm, I have to get through experience and imagination. So here we go. Where do writers get their ideas from? From experience, obviously. And from imagination. That's less obvious. Fiction results from imagination working on experience. We shape experience in our minds so that it makes sense. We force the world to be coherent, to tell us a story. I don't think only fiction writers do this. We all do it. We all do it constantly in order to be sane and to survive. People who can't make the world into a story go mad. Or like infants, or maybe animals, they live in a world that has no history, no time but now. Now, the minds of animals are a great and sacred and present mystery. I do think animals have languages, but they're entirely truthful languages. It seems like human beings are the only people who can lie. who can think and say what is not so and never was so, or what has never been and yet might be. Animals don't do that. We can invent, we can suppose, we can imagine, and all that it's all mixed in with memory. And so we're the only animals, I think, who tell stories. Now, an ape can extrapolate from her experience. Once I stuck a stick into that ant hill, and the ants crawled on it, and I like ants. And so if I put this stick in that ant hill again, maybe the ants will crawl on it again, and I can lick them off. Yum. But only we human beings can imagine. We can tell the story about the ape who stuck a stick in an anthill, and it came out covered with gold dust, and a prospector saw it. And that was the beginning of the great gold rush of 1877 in Rhodesia. Now, that story's not true. It's only a relation to reality is that some apes do stick sticks in some anthills. There was no gold rush in 1877 in Rhodesia. I made it up. I am a human, therefore I lie. All humans are liars. That is true. You must believe me. Okay. Fiction. Fiction, imagination working on experience. A great deal of what we consider our experience, our memory, our hard-earned knowledge, our history, is in fact fiction. I'm married to an historian, and I have been allowed to say this. But never mind that. I am talking about real fiction, stories, novels, that stuff. They all come from the writer's experience of reality, worked upon and changed, filtered, distorted, clarified, transfigured by imagination. Ideas come from the world through the head. Now, the interesting part of this process to me is the passage through the head, the action of the imagination on the raw material, but that is the part of the process that I find a great many people actually disapprove of.
You're listening to a talk by Ursula K. Le Guin. She's the writer this time on Literary Arts, The Archive Project. More with Le Guin is coming up right after this break. This is Literary Arts, The Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. This time, we're bringing you a talk by science fiction writer Ursula K. Le Guin. She spoke in Portland in 2000.
I wrote a piece years ago called Why Are Americans Afraid of Dragons? And in it, I talked about how so many Americans distrust and despise not only the obviously imaginative kind of fiction we call fantasy, but all fiction. And how they rationalize their fear and contempt with financial or religious arguments, reading novels is a waste of valuable time. The only true book is the Bible, and so on. I said then that many Americans have been taught, quote, to repress their imagination, to reject it as something childish or effeminate, unprofitable, and probably sinful. They have learned to fear the imagination, but they have never learned to discipline it at all. I wrote that in 1974. The millennium has come and we are still afraid of dragons. Our fear has taken some forms I want to talk about now. One of them is the tactic of infantilizing fantasy. Fantasy's for children, right? It's kiddie lit. It's cute. But fantasy has also shown that it can make money. You got to take that seriously. So the Harry Potter books. Perfectly amiable, perfectly conventional children's fantasies get praised for their originality by reviewers who are apparently completely ignorant of the tradition the books derive from. A tradition that descends from the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, the Thousand and One Nights, and Beowulf, and the Tale of Monkey, and medieval romance, and Renaissance epic, through Kipling and Borges and Calvino and Rushdie, a form of literature which is not well described as cute, which is not easily dismissed as entertainment or great fun for the kiddies, or, well, at least they're reading something. The Potter fad is a godsend to those who want fantasy to be childish, harmless, and nice. Now, American critics have been trying for 40 years to bury one of the great works of 20th century fiction, The Lord of the Rings. They ignore it, they condescend to it, they pat it on the head, they stand in large groups with their backs to it, because they're afraid of it. They're afraid of dragons. And Tolkien knew that when he wrote his piece called The Monsters and the Critics. They know if they acknowledge Tolkien, they will have to admit that fantasy can be literature and that therefore they will have to redefine what literature is. What American critics and teachers call literature is still almost wholly restricted to realism, a nice little genre of its own. All other forms of fiction, westerns, mystery, science fiction, fantasy, romance, historical, regional, you name it, is dismissed as genre. They don't even have an English word for it. They have to have a French word, where nobody basically can pronounce. They send it to the ghetto. Another foreign word. That the ghetto is about 12 times larger than the city and currently a great deal livelier doesn't bother people who live in ivory towers. But magical realism, oh wow, that bothers them. They can hear Gabriel Garcia Marquez gnawing quietly at the foundations of the ivory tower. They hear all those crazy Indians up in the attic. They think maybe they should do something about it. Maybe we should give that fellow who teaches the SF course tenure after all? Oh, no, surely not. Well, to say that realistic fiction is by definition superior to imaginative fiction is to imply that imitation is superior to invention. I wonder if this unstated but widely accepted and incidentally very puritanical proposition, I wonder if it's related to the recent popularity of the memoir and the personal essay. I hope it isn't. Because this has been a real popularity, not a matter of academic canon making. People really do want to read memoir and personal essay, and writers really do want to write it. But I have felt kind of out of step with all this. I like history and biography fine, but family and personal memoirs, this is, to me, this is stuff you talk about. but not stuff you write. So I have searched my soul for prejudice, and I found it. I prefer invention to imitation. I love novels. I love made-up stuff. Now, to put a high value on story drawn directly from personal experience is a logical extension of our high value for realism in fiction. If fiction is expected to adhere in all respects to actual experience, if faithful imitation of reality is its great virtue, then memoir is a lot more virtuous than fiction. The memoir writer's imagination, subordinated to hard facts, serves to connect them aesthetically and draw from them a moral or intellectual lesson. But the memoir writer should be strictly forbidden to invent. And as for the reader's imagination, if there's nothing in the story outside familiar experience, the imagination may not be called on at all. Recognition rather than discovery may be the reward. It's a beautiful reward, as Bruce says. The personal essay is a noble and difficult discipline. I'm not knocking it, but I'm not at home in it myself. I keep looking for dragons in this country and not finding them, or finding them disguised. Some of the most praised recent memoirs have been about growing up in poverty, hopeless poverty, cruel fathers, incompetent mothers, abused children, misery, fear, loneliness. Is this the property of nonfiction? It sounds to me like the population of folk tales and fairy tales and legends and horror stories. Poverty, cruelty, incompetence, dysfunctional families, injustice, degradation, it's the very stuff of the fireside tale. The ground of our experience is dark, and all our inventions start in darkness. From them, some of them leap forth in fire. Imagination can transfigure the dark matter of life. And that's what I begin to miss sometimes. To recognize our shared familiar misery isn't enough. I want to recognize something I never saw before. I want something to leap out at me, terrible and blazing. I want the fire of the transfiguring imagination. I want the true, implacable dragons. Experience is where ideas come from, but a story isn't a mirror of what happened. Fiction is experience translated by, transformed by, transfigured by the imagination. Truth includes but is not coextensive with fact. Truth in art isn't imitation, it's reincarnation. So the raw material of experience to be valuable in a factual history has to be selected and arranged and shaped. And in a novel, the process gets much more radical. The raw materials are not only selected and shaped, but they're composted and recombined and reworked and reconfigured and reborn. And also at the same time, allowed to find their own forms and shapes, which may not be clear to rational thinking, so that the whole thing may seem to be pure invention. A girl chained to a rock as a sacrifice to a monster. A mad captain and a white whale. A dragon. There is no such thing as pure invention. Invention is recombination. We can only work with what we have. It all starts with experience. There are monsters and leviathans and chimeras in the human mind. They're psychic facts. Dragons are one of the truths about us. We have no other way of expressing that particular truth about us. People who deny the existence of dragons are often eaten by dragons. Now, another way we've taken recently of showing our deep distrust of the imagination, our puritanical lust to control it is the way we tell stories electronically, on TV and in media such as electronic games and CD-ROMs. I think that reading is an act. It's active. To read a story is to participate actively in the story. To read is to tell the story to yourself, rewriting it with the author, word by word, sentence by sentence, chapter by chapter. If you want proof, watch an 8-year-old reading a story she likes. She is concentratedly, fiercely alive in her imagination. She is absorbing the story. She is as intense as a hunting cat. Reading is a very mysterious act. It absolutely has not been replaced and will not be replaced by any kind of viewing, because viewing is an entirely different undertaking with different stakes and different rewards. Viewing, I think, is passive. A reader reading makes the book, brings it into meaning by translating those arbitrary printed symbols, printed letters, translating it into an inward private reality. A viewer watching a film does not make the film. To watch a film is to be taken into it, to participate in it, to be made part of it, absorbed by it. Readers eat books, but films eat viewers. This is fine. I love to be eaten by a good movie, you know? I love to let my eyes and ears take my mind into a reality I could never otherwise know. But passivity means vulnerability. And that's what an awful lot of media storytelling exploits. Reading is an active transaction between the text and the reader. The text is under the control of the reader. She can skip or linger or interpret or misinterpret. She can return or ponder or go along with the story or refuse to go along with the story, make judgments, revise her judgments. The reader really has time and room to genuinely interact. A novel is an active, ongoing collaboration between the writer and the reader, to me. Now, viewing is not a transaction. It's not collaborative. The viewer consents to participate and hands over control to the filmmaker or the programmer. Psychically, I don't think there's any time or room outside an audiovisual narrative, the show you're watching. There's no room for anything but the show, particularly if it's a narrative. For the viewer, the video or the computer screen becomes the universe. There's no way to control the constant stream of information and imagery and event except by shifting to another stream, channel hopping, or turning the program off. There's a lot of talk about transactional viewing, and interacting is a favorite word of programmers. But I think the electronic media are a paradise of control for programmers and a paradise of passivity for viewers. There is nothing, there can be nothing in so-called interactive programs except what the programmer put in them. The choices, so-called, lead to sub-programs chosen by the programmer. They're no more a choice than a footnote is. You either read it or you don't. The roles in role-playing games are fixed and conventional. There are no characters in games. They're only personae. That's why teenagers love them. They need personae. Hypertext offers the storyteller a wonderful complexity, but so far hypertext fiction seems to be like Borges's Garden of Forking Paths that lead only to other forking paths. It's fascinating, like fractals and nightmarish. Interactivity, in the sense of the viewer controlling the text, is to me even more nightmarish. When it's interpreted to mean that the viewer can rewrite the novel. If you don't like the end of Moby Dick, you can change it. You can make a happy ending. Ahab kills the whale? Yeah. Well, readers can't kill the whale. They don't have that option. They can only reread until they understand why Ahab made it kill him. Readers don't control the text. They genuinely interact with it. Viewers, I think, are either controlled by the program or try to control it. And those are different ball games, different universes. Now, recently the Oregonian ran a story that began, "Millions of young readers have loved The Little Prince since it was published in 1943, but they have never experienced Saint-Exupéry's classic fable quite like this." And then they describe a 3D animated version narrated by Kenneth Branagh. Quote, "It offers more than just the story of The Little Prince. You can, for example, catch an orbiting planet in The Little Prince's universe and learn all about the planet's secrets and its inhabitants." Well, this kind of sent me back to the book. And I thought that, as I remembered, the prince visits several planets with extremely interesting inhabitants. And his own tiny little planet has an immense secret, a rose. And he's in love with the rose. Now, do the makers of the CD-ROM, do they feel that Saint-Exupéry was stingy with his planets or something? Or are they just convinced that stuffing irrelevant information into a work of art enriches it? So that maybe we get a CD-ROM of The Tempest, and when Miranda says, "Oh, brave new world that has such creatures in it," you can press a button, and on the screen there will be information about a genuine virtual new world with creatures in it. In the Little Prince CD-ROM, you can also enter the fox training game, and after you have tamed the fox that the Little Prince meets, he will give you a gift. Now, do you remember the fox in the Little Prince? I thought I did, but I had to go back to the book. And the fox insists that the Little Prince tame him. "Why?" says the little prince. And the fox says, "Well, if I'm tamed, I will always love the wheat fields because they are the color of your hair." And so the little prince, that convinces him, and he says, "Well, how do I tame you?" And the fox says, "By being very patient. You sit down at a little distance from me in the grass. I shall look at you out of the corner of my eye, and you will say nothing. Words are the source of misunderstanding. But you will sit a little closer to me every day." And it turns out it should be at the same time every day so that the fox will know at what hour my heart is to be ready to greet you. One must observe the proper rites. And so, eventually, the fox is tamed. And then the little prince is about to leave. "Ah," says the fox, "I shall cry." So the little prince laments, "Being tamed didn't do you any good." But the fox says, "It has done me good because of the color of the wheat fields." And when they part, the fox says, "I will make you a present of a secret. It's the time you wasted for your rose that makes your rose important. You become responsible forever for what you have tamed." Well, so then the kid viewing the CD-ROM tames the fox that presses buttons till the food pellet drops. The child selects the right choices from the program till informed that the fox is tamed. Okay. Now, this does not seem to me quite the same as imagining doing what the book says, coming back every day at the same time and sitting silently while a fox looks at you from the corner of its eye. Something essential has been short-circuited. What do you think the fox's gift is in the CD-ROM? I have no idea. But I don't see how it can top the fox's gift in the book, which is a few words. You become responsible forever for what you have tamed. The gift the little prince gives its readers is itself. It offers them absolutely nothing but a charming story with a few charming pictures and the chance to face fear, grief, tenderness, and loss. Which is, I guess, why that story, written in the middle of a war by a man about to die in that war, is still honored by children and adults and even literary critics. Maybe the CD-ROM isn't as ghastly as it sounds, but it's hard not to see it as an effort to exploit, to tame something that, like a real fox, has to be left wild. That is the imagination of an artist. Big, long stories, novels, don't come from one stimulus or idea, but a whole clumping and concatenation of ideas and images and visions and mental perceptions, all slowly, gradually drawing in around some center, which is usually obscure to me until long after the book is done. And I finally say, oh, that's what that book is about. During this process, to me, two things are essential. During the sort of clumping together, before I know much of anything about this story, in order to begin the story, I have to see the place, the landscape, where it is. And I have to know who it is, the people, the principal people, by name. I have to know those people by name, and it has to be the right name. If it's the wrong name, the character won't come to me. I won't know who they are. I won't be able to be them, to write down what they say. They won't talk. They won't do anything. Please don't ask me how I arrive at the name and how I know when it's the right name, because I have no idea. When I hear it, I know it. It's one of these waiting and listening things. And then I know where they are, and then the story can begin. Here is an example, my book that came out in September, The Telling. The idea, I think in the sense that most people understand this word, idea, for the novel, came to me in this way. I learned that the Taoist religion, an ancient, popular, complex religion, major element of Chinese culture, had been basically wiped out by Mao Zedong. Taoism as a practice now apparently exists only in Taiwan, possibly underground on the mainland, possibly not. In one generation, one psychopathic tyrant destroyed a tradition 2,000 or 2,500 years old. In one lifetime, my lifetime, and I knew nothing about it while it was happening. The enormity of the event and the enormity of my ignorance left me dazed. I had to think about it. I had to try to cope with this. And since the way I think is fiction, I eventually had to write a story about it. But I can't write a novel about China. I don't know anything about China. Poverty of experience. So it had to be a novel set on an imagined world, and that's the beauty of science fiction. A novel about the extinction of a religion as a deliberate political act, yeah. Okay, balanced maybe by the suppression of political freedom by a theocracy. All right, there's a nice theme. There's a good situation, an idea, if you will. So I'm impatient to get started. This is great. Oh, I love this. I love this. So I look for the people who are going to tell me the story, the people who are going to live this story. And I find this uppity kid, this smart girl who goes from Earth to that world. I don't even remember what her name was. She had 5 different names, none of them right. I started the book 5 times. It got nowhere. It went
I was in despair. I had to shut up and stop and sit and be patient and say nothing at the same time every day while the fox looked at me from the corner of its eye and slowly let me get a little bit closer. And finally, when I shut up, the woman whose story it was began to talk to me, and she said, "I'm Sudhi. I'm from India." "India?" I said, "Yeah, follow me," she said. So I followed her, and she led me up into the mountains, and she gave me the book. So what I had was a good idea, but I did not have a story. The story had to make itself. It had to find its center, find its voice, which was Sati's voice. And then, because I was waiting for it, it could give itself to me. Or put it this way, I had a whole lot of stuff in my head, but I couldn't pull it together. I couldn't dance that dance because I hadn't waited to catch the beat. I didn't have the rhythm. So I come back at last to Virginia Woolf's letter to her friend Vita. Vita had been pontificating about finding the right word. You know, Flaubert's the mot juste. And she'd been agonizing very Frenchly about style. And Virginia wrote back very Englishly. "As for the mot juste, you are quite wrong. Style is a very simple matter. It's all rhythm. Once you get that, you can't use the wrong words. But on the other hand, here am I sitting after half the morning crammed with ideas and visions and so on, and I can't dislodge them for lack of the right rhythm." Now, this is very profound, what rhythm is. It goes far deeper than words. A sight, an emotion, creates this wave in the mind long before it makes words to fit it. And in writing, such is my present belief, one has to recapture this and set this working, which has nothing apparently to do with words. And then, as it breaks and tumbles in the mind, it makes words to fit it. But no doubt I shall think differently next year. Well, Woolf wrote that 75 years ago. And if she did think differently next year, she didn't tell anybody. She says it lightly, but she means it. This is very profound. I have not found anything more profound or more useful about the source of story, where the ideas really come from. Beneath memory and experience, beneath imagination and invention, beneath words, as she says, there are rhythms to which memory and imagination and words all move. And the writer's job is to go down deep enough to begin to feel that rhythm, to find it, to move to it, to be moved by it, and let it move memory and imagination to find the words. She's full of ideas, but she can't dislodge them, she says, because she can't find their rhythm. She can't find the beat that will unlock them, set them moving forward into a story, get them to telling themselves. A wave in the mind, she calls it. She says that a sight or an emotion may create it. And my image there was a stone dropped into still water, and the circles go out from the center in silence, in perfect rhythm. And the mind follows those circles outward and outward till they turn to words. But that's really not her image. Her image is much greater. Her wave is a sea wave, traveling smooth and silent from Japan to Oregon till it strikes the shore and crashes and breaks and flies up in a foam of words. But the wave, the rhythmic impulse, is before words, has nothing to do with words. So the writer's job is to recognize the wave, that silent swell, way out at sea, way out in the ocean of the mind, and follow it to shore, where it can turn or be turned into words. and unload its story, throw out its imagery, pour out its secrets, and then ebb back into the ocean of story. What is it that prevents the ideas and visions from finding their necessary underlying rhythm? Why couldn't Wolf dislodge them that morning? Well, it could be a thousand things, distractions and worries. But very often, I think what keeps a writer from finding the words is that she grasps at them too soon. She hurries, she grabs at them. She doesn't wait for the wave to come in and break. She wants to write because she's a writer. She wants to say this, and she wants to tell people that, and show people something else, and things she knows, her ideas, her opinions, her beliefs, important things. But she doesn't wait for the wave to come and carry her beyond all the ideas and opinions to where you cannot use the wrong word. None of us is Virginia Woolf, but I hope every writer here has had at least a moment when they rode the wave and all the words were right. Prose and poetry, all art, music, dance, rise from and move with the profound rhythms of our body, our being, the body and being of our world. Physicists read the universe as a great range of vibrations, of rhythms. Art follows and expresses those rhythms. Once we get the beat, the right beat, our ideas and our words dance to it, the round dance that everybody can join. And then I am thou, and the barriers are down for a while. Thank you.
That was Ursula K. Le Guin. She spoke in Portland in 2000 as part of Portland Arts and Lectures. Le Guin is the author of over 60 books in just about every genre of literature. Thanks so much for joining us for Literary Arts, the Archive Project. Ursula K. Le Guin was our featured writer this time. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. I hope you can join us next time. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. We have all our talks online. You can browse through them at literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thank you for joining us.